Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Kernaghis, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is a man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Dawn. Great to be here today.
So today we have a good friend of ours on the show, Dr. David LeMay, a sports medicine and rehabilitation physician who has a practice here in Pensacola called Lifestyle and Performance Medicine. Dave and his partner provide personalized preventative care that helps people reduce the effects of stress on the body and mind to maximize function and health. In addition to his practice here in Pensacola, Dave also is consultant for the NBA's Washington Wizards, the NFL's Oakland Raiders, and the NHL's Washington Capitals, who actually just won the Stanley Cup this year, their first in their franchise history.
In his practice, Dave works with a lot of athletes as well as retired and active duty military members, especially people in special ops who often have inflammation as a result of persistent injuries and other traumas. Dave often recommends specialized pro-resolving mediators, also known as SPMs, which can help promote the natural resolution of the inflammation process and allow a person to avoid anti-inflammatory drugs for the most part. We will be talking with Dave about this rather new method of treatment in today's interview.
But before we get to today's interview with Dave, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk. We are especially appreciative of all the wonderful five-star reviews that have been piling up.
As we announced in several earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing iTunes, Google, Overcast, Stitcher, and other podcast apps for the wittiest and most lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. As always, if you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us. to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by Ephemeroptera on iTunes and is titled Best Science Podcast Except for Mine. It reads, I love the interviews on this podcast. The interviewers are good scientists and ask good questions, but also delve into personal history and background, which makes the speaker more accessible. Hearing stories of how they got into science is something we can all relate to, and then I am always inspired to learn more about their science. Keep them coming.
Thank you, Ephemeroptera, and thank you to all our other STEM Talk listeners who have helped STEM Talk become such a great success. Before we get to our interview today, I want to congratulate Dawn, who was recently named the recipient of the Undersea and Hyperbaric Medical Society's Young Scientist Award. Yeah! This award recognizes the work of a young medical doctor or scientist whose performance is consistently outstanding. The recipient can be either a clinician or a researcher practicing in hyperbaric and/or diving medicine and must not be older than 40 years of age. As our STEM Talk listeners have probably figured out, Dawn is certainly a deserving honoree. Dawn, enjoy these Young Scientist Awards while you can. A scientific career seems to pass in but a blink of the eye, and you will soon be winning Lifetime Achievement Awards.
Well, thank you so much, Ken. This award was such a surprise, and I've been blessed to be surrounded by inspirational colleagues like you and others who have helped me over the years. I was really honored to receive this recognition. It was quite a humbling experience.
Well, certainly it is well-deserved, and congratulations again. Okay, and now on to today's interview with Dr. Dave LeMay.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. I'm your host, Dawn Kernaghis, and joining us today is Dave LeMay. Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us is Ken Ford.
Hello, Dawn, and hello, David.
So, Dave, let's just get started with your background. I understand that as a kid growing up in Reno, Nevada, that you played sports nonstop. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, as much as I was able to, I played. It doesn't matter what it was. I just enjoyed activity.
Being outside.
Yep.
Because you love sports so much, you ended up with some injuries, though. And I hear that you broke a few fingers and tore some ligaments. And that's actually how you first became interested in science. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
I think I was always interested in science in general, but that kind of gravitated me towards the medical side. And there's nothing catastrophic. I mean, I think I broke my wrist one time doing something crazy, jumping off a swing or something. But more than anything, it was, you know, doing things like playing football in the backyard with other kids and, you know, just catching something off the end of my finger and bending something backwards. And so I would just start kind of looking at those things and saying, well, I want to keep playing. I don't want to stop playing. So I would just, you know, buddy tape my fingers, which is a common thing that, you know, a trainer would do. But right. just as a kid, it just made sense. Well, mm-hmm. I can make it work. So it was just a matter of wanting to not be on the sidelines watching.
Yeah, and, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So after high school, you headed to California to attend Azusa Pacific University. How did you decide on that?
You know, my brother was there. I looked at a couple of places, smaller schools. My dad taught chemistry for 40 years at University of Nevada. One of the things that he encouraged us to do is to just look at going for, at least for undergraduate, to a smaller school, just because it's easier to get to know people. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of his experience. He went to a smaller school for undergraduate and then Illinois for his grad school. And I could have stayed at Nevada. You know, I did some of my undergraduate at Nevada, Reno, but it just was a smaller school. My brother went there and I enjoyed the atmosphere that was there. I wrestled in high school and I wrestled a lot. I had a few scholarship offers for smaller schools to wrestle, but the weight cutting didn't appeal to me too much in college. So I decided, you know, just to go there. And then I loved it. I ended up walking on to our track team, which was great. We had 8 athletes on our team that were in the 92 Olympics.
Wow.
Yeah, I was definitely not one of those, but I enjoyed being around it. It was a lot of fun.
That's really cool. So after Azusa, what led you back home to go to med school at the University of Reno?
I think the biggest thing was I was accepted.
Well, that's so good. That's a good starting point.
I know. So I applied to schools, and I think sometimes as a pre-med student, people have the idea that you have to find the best school you could possibly go to. You know, if I can get into Harvard, I'm going to Harvard. And that for some people, that's great. But, you know, going to a state school was, you know, cost was good. A lot of individual one-on-one type teaching with the faculty and the doctors that they had. So it appealed to me.
Yeah.
When did you decide to specialize in physical medicine and rehabilitation, or was that always sort of your plan right along?
No, I think initially, actually, I was looking at orthopedics, and I still like orthopedics. So I looked at the possibility of doing orthopedics, and what kind of spurred me away from that is I really like time in clinic. And a lot of those guys they do so much trauma call and things at nighttime, and, you know, repairing a femur at 2 o'clock in the morning was not what kind of got my juices flowing. I really liked the clinic and interacting with patients one-on-one. So a friend of mine who was a physical therapist, who I went through medical school with, who practices now up in Colorado, he was looking at doing orthopedics too, but he said, you know, I was a physical therapist at a group that had a bunch of orthopedists and they had a physiatrist. So you ought to look into that. That's kind of where I started down that road. And it was difficult because I would go in and talk to groups and say, hey, do you have a physiatrist? And they would say, well, we don't deal with mental disorders. It's not a psychiatrist. It's different.
Yeah. Like, okay, apparently you don't then.
Yeah.
We had a physiatrist on STEM Talk earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And talking about traumatic brain injury.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right.
Absolutely. Yep. It was great talk.
So the University of Texas Health Science Center has one of the best physical medicine and rehab programs in the country. Is that why you decided to go there for your residency?
Yeah, I really liked the program. I felt like I would get a lot more sort of outpatient musculoskeletal exposure there. And the person who wrote the textbook on electrodiagnostics is kind of the Bible of doing EMGs and nerve conduction studies at the time was the program director. And so that also attracted me. But we spent time in the pain clinics and the procedures were part of that. I spent about 7 months on orthopedic rotations, including 2 months on trauma there, 2 months of neurosurgery trauma. So I kind of felt like if I wanted to do an outpatient musculoskeletal practice, that would be the way to go.
Hmm. After your residency, you stayed in Austin for perhaps a year. You decided to open practice in Pensacola. How did that transition work? What motivated that evolution?
Yeah, so I was actually in San Antonio and I was practicing there. The great group of people I have a lot of respect for. But I did more inpatient rehab there because that was what was available and not you know, that's something some people absolutely love. And for me, there are parts of it I really liked, but I wanted to do more outpatient. And a close friend of mine who was a year behind me in residency was looking at jobs and looked at a position in Pensacola, and they wanted two people. So he kind of talked me into coming out with them.
That's great.
And you were at the Andrews Institute here until 2013 when you and your partner decided to branch out on your own. Can you tell us a little bit about your practice, which is called Lifestyle and Performance Medicine?
Yeah, I started down a kind of different, I've always been interested in nutrition and sort of metabolic things. So even when I was interested in sports medicine, all the guys on the track team would come to me with questions, you know, so they didn't want to raise a red flag with the Olympic committee and say, hey, this person brought something called creatine around to practice and I don't know what it is or what it does. Can you go research it? So, you know, I was not a threat to make the Olympics again. So it was easy for me to go research that stuff. So I always had that interest. But when I was in practice at Andrews Institute, I would see a lot of military guys come through and, you know, they're beat up and they're young. They're very motivated people. And a lot of the tools that I had to try to help them, just they weren't enough. And they had good docs treating them. They had great physical therapy. They had nutritionists working with them. So something was missing. And that was kind of the rabbit hole. I have to dig. And so I kept digging, you know, and kind of finding different layers to the problems that these guys would have. And as that kind of grew, I just realized I can't do this in a traditional medical model. And that was the spur for me to say, I need to probably just branch away and do this on my own.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I understand that veterans and some active duty folks typically doing special ops type work comprise a good chunk of your practice currently, maybe about half. And you're also seeing a lot of neuroendocrine dysfunction in that group. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's very common. It's a hard topic, I think, because there's a little bit of taboo that goes with it, but it's a real thing. If you look at a lot of these guys that are active duty or recently out of, you know, a high intensity, you know, work like special operations, you'll see that endocrine function is kind of low normal. So you've got these really high motivated people who train regularly and work hard, and they're looking at diet and they're all about health, but you know, things like testosterone or cortisol, DHEA, these hormones are not what you would expect to see in a healthy, let's say 35 or 40 year old. They're just not what you would expect to see.
Right. And you know, it wasn't that way when they went through selection.
Absolutely correct. Yeah. And there are some studies, even the Army's done some studies looking at Rangers that, you know, coming through Ranger school for 6 weeks and testing growth hormone, testing testosterone, and looking at explosive power before and afterwards. And you know, it's not surprising to see what their findings were at the end of that 6 week period. Their explosive power was significantly less. The testosterone and the growth hormone levels were much lower, and cortisol was much higher.
Yeah, absolutely. You're the medical director for a program run through the NFL Players Association Trust that Exos manages. Can you describe the type of rehab that this program provides to the former NFL players?
It involves giving these guys good nutritional guidance, at least some background, and then functional exercise and correcting biomechanical problems. So when you think about these guys, most of them are really beat up, and that's why they get out. They don't get out on their own terms, unfortunately, mostly. So they're beat up. They may or may not have the tools that they need to have a really healthy lifestyle. But if you want to have a healthy brain, you also have to have a healthy lifestyle. So we start working on biomechanical issues and then get them back into an exercise program. And they're allowed to do that in a fairly comfortable setting.
Yes, I ran into a couple of those gentlemen at Exos when I was rehabbing my shoulder. And you could see that they were going to have a lifelong issue. Both of these guys didn't move well at all.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the longer time you're injured, you also start to develop bad habits of movement, and those create new problems. And that's the same thing that happens in metabolism. If you look at things from a biomechanical standpoint, when you start walking different because you have a knee problem, so you start having a lurching gait, or you have a Trendelenburg gait, or something changes biomechanically, now you've created a problem somewhere else. So you have to go back to the original source, start correcting some of those abnormal movement patterns before you can get somebody into an exercise program.
Yeah, one of these guys, I always knew when he was around or not around because his gym shoes were about 2 feet long. And I wondered, how does anyone walk with a foot that big?
Yeah, yeah. It's true. It's a, you know, these people are just genetically amazing. Yeah. And basketball players too. You know, it's not like I can borrow a pair of shoes from any of the guys that I see.
Well, you could, but
yeah, I'd look like a clown.
So talking about this whole concept of these guys being really beat up, inflammation is a unifying component of many diseases that afflict Western civilization. And it's also a major contributor to the magnitude and persistence of different sports injuries and also traumas. So can you talk about this and specifically the role of inflammation and concussion and traumatic brain injury? And as I say that, maybe it would be beneficial if you could give our listeners a brief primer on inflammation just in general.
Yeah. So with inflammation, it's a process that we're having a developing and growing understanding of. So the way I think of it is we've been looking at this as a two-dimensional problem. You take omega-6 fats, you activate those through enzymes, convert to arachidonic acid. That then is converted through COX and LOX through different enzymes into chemical fatty mediators that cause an immune reaction. Mm-hmm. So the way I look at omega-6 fats is like a key that doesn't have any teeth. So the enzymes will carve the teeth into it. Now it can turn a lock and do something. So those endpoints, prostaglandins, as an example, will call in part of your immune system, the neutrophils, into an area. And the neutrophils' role is to come in and clean up. They'll come in and clean up debris. They kill off bacteria and start to get rid of the damaged tissue. Traditionally, we think of that as a process that you want to happen for a short bit, but you want it to be limited and we want to block it from happening so that you can heal. But that's not true because the enzymes in that pathway are the same exact enzymes in another pathway that we've recently basically figured out exists, which is the resolution pathway. So that's an active pathway. It's not a passive process. So you take omega-6 fats, and those omega-6 fats are then converted through the same enzymes, COX and LOX, into what are called pro-resolution mediators or specialized pro-resolving mediators. And there's three main classes of them that we know exist. There's resolvins, protectins, and maresins. And what happens when those are activated is that the neutrophil infiltration tends to get slowed down or shut down because macrophages come into an area. So initially you get pro-inflammatory macrophages that come in, M1 type macrophages. They come into an area and kind of finish off some of that debridement and cleanup, but then they switch to a resolution phase, an M2 macrophage, and that starts the rebuilding process, the repair process. So if you're taking things to block inflammation, often what you're doing is also impairing the resolution process. So healing is very difficult. So in understanding that, the mindset for how to care for an injury, how do you deal with a traumatic brain injury? As an example, you know, we looked initially at dealing with brain injuries and spinal cord injuries, we'd put them on high-dose steroids. Mm-hmm. We start looking at our anti-inflammatory medications an option for these people. A lot of the symptoms that develop as a result of these injuries, we use non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications. And, you know, short spurts in the right circumstances probably reasonable, but it's not the answer to how to treat these things.
You've also been looking at how targeting inflammation may serve as a therapeutic way to treat fear and anxiety-based orders. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're learning in that space?
Yeah. So if you're looking, for example, at something like PTSD, is PTSD the result of chronic emotional stress? It may be. Is it the result of traumatic stress, you know, a concussion, TBI? It may be that too. So there's an overlap that exists, and the common link in that is inflammation. So when you are in a chronic state of stress and cortisol is high, your immune system is activated. So we think of cortisol as a, you know, as an anti-inflammatory type chemical, but it's slowing down part of your immune system, but there's another part that actually gets overactive, and you have a tendency to stay in this inflammatory state, particularly in the brain. That process in activating immune cells within the brain, like microglial cells, they produce more chemicals or cytokines that end up leading to sort of a breakdown or destruction of some of the vital structures within the brain. Things like the hippocampus, mm-hmm. Which is your short-term memory and your visual spatial awareness center in the brain, also serves as a governor for the HPA axis, so the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So control of what happens with cortisol and DHEA under stress responses, that also becomes, I guess, damaged or changed over time. It can become hyperactive initially and then hypoactive or underactive once enough damage has occurred. So there's a link there with inflammation through chemical mediators, those cytokines. And when you have a traumatic injury, it's the same sort of concept. You start out with a coup, contra coup, that's the bruising. axonal shearing happens. So the connections between those cells, sort of the extension cords, get whipped around, particularly if there's any rotational forces. But that starts a secondary injury, which is going to be, you know, an inflammation problem and then a metabolic problem. It's not an issue that you can treat typically with just giving somebody a medication. They just don't stop the process. And that's why it's such a difficult thing to handle. Mm-hmm. Comes down to immune activation and then the production of reactive oxygen species from sort of this hypermetabolic state where you're producing too much ATP, or your mitochondria, the nuclear power plants in your cells, are trying really hard to increase their production of energy, that energy demand. And then you, as that goes on for a period of time, then you create a hypometabolic state, a state where you can't produce enough energy, and that cycles out of control. So whether it's stress-induced, whether it's traumatically induced, they kind of go hand in hand, and inflammation and oxidative stress is the common link with that. Yeah.
Earlier in our discussion of specialized pro-resolving mediators, you mentioned that EPA and DHA must be converted into SPMs through an enzymatic process. Would this kind of process be diminished in its efficiency as one ages, or is that not a factor?
Yeah, it does tend to be diminished. I'm not sure that we understand exactly why that happens, but it is diminished as we age. Hmm. Also, if you look at people who have metabolic syndrome, so if they're struggling with insulin regulation and fatty acid regulation issues, if you give them EPA and DHA, they don't make pro-resolution mediators. So there's a process that's broken there somewhere.
So do you think in the aging population, there's a role for exogenous SPMs?
Yes, I do. Yeah. And what I find, even if you were to just look at it from the standpoint of wear and tear arthritis, we just say functional, not even talking about brain, but you know, all of us, as we age, these situations, we start to develop pain that limits us from activity, and it's a downward spiral into deconditioning and loss of muscle mass and those things that obviously are catastrophic. But pro-resolution mediators help with pain. So it helps with pain, helps with the repair process. And from a functional standpoint, I'm seeing the guys that I work with who are high performers that are, you know, they're constantly in an inflammatory state, you know, pro athlete or a special operations guy or somebody who was retired, they, you know, from the special operations aspect of the military, they're very active and they stay in that inflammatory state. The feedback on taking these has been really, really good.
Hmm. Is there a particular SPM brand or collection of brands that you find most interesting and efficacious? What is the difference between the various available SPMs?
Well, there's one manufacturer in the world, and that's Solutex in Spain. So Solutex manufactures them, and then they ship them over to the United States. So they're, as far as distribution, one company is Metagenics, and that's a provider. I mean, they go through healthcare providers. But what I'm using with the pro sports world, because it's NSF certified, sports certified, but also within the military, is ProResolve, which is by Omega Fort. And people can order them online now. I think it's ProResolveSPMS.com is the website, but people can direct order those.
What dosage do you suggest for subacute inflammation? And what about during an acute inflammation stage? Also, as if that's not enough of a question, what about folks who experience this sort of ongoing mild inflammation? As some folks tend to be mildly inflamed all the time, as measured by like high sensitivity, CRP, things like that. Do SPMs have a role with those folks?
It seems to decrease C-reactive protein. There aren't any, that I know of, there aren't any large studies looking at that and how much of an effect it has, like what percentage of typical drop you would see. But for sure, for people who have a chronic state of inflammation, there's really no way to get out of that without resolution mediators. Mm. You just can't. And what I've typically done with the patients that I'm working with is I try to keep them about a gram a day for a chronic state, a half a gram to a gram a day. Usually when they're at a gram a day, they notice a big difference. They feel the difference, less achy. A lot of the military guys, the description I have is that's given to me from them is they wake up in the morning without the pain train.
Yeah.
So they get up and they can move. It's not, you know, creaking into the bathroom to try to get moving. And that's the feedback that I get from people who have sort of a degenerative arthritis. In acute injuries, I tend to gravitate more towards higher doses. I'd say, you know, 2 grams, and I've even suggested up to 4 grams of SPMs for about a week. And what I see with an acute, let's say a hamstring strain or ligament strain, something like that, is just that the healing process is really sped. Mm. So instead of a 6-week return to play, you know, maybe it's 3 or 4 weeks, you have a better chance of getting back into sports-specific training and rehabilitation quicker to allow guys to do return to play earlier. So very, very helpful for that as well.
Yeah, it's interesting for sure. You're a consultant for the NBA's Washington Wizards, the NFL's Oakland Raiders, and the National Hockey League's Washington Capitals, who just recently won the Stanley Cup this year. That must have been exciting. How did your work with the Capitals and the other professional teams come about?
It started mainly because I think working with the military guys that I have, a close friend of mine is a therapist, was working over at Exos and took a job with the Wizards. And they had some issues with some players, you know, just health issues and kind of being, you know, beat down. It's just a chronic inflammatory state. So asked if I could come help with some of those guys. And so I came up and worked with a couple of players, and their feedback was good. So they started having me work with the whole team. And then once that happened, the same ownership exists for the Capitals. And so they kind of pushed me over to that side too, and asked, you know, if I'd be willing to work with the Capitals. I could ask the Capitals if they would want to work with me. So we started working together about 3 years ago. I've had three good, really good solid seasons. I think two President's Trophies and one Stanley Cup's kind of good.
Yeah, that sums it up pretty well.
Yeah. And then working with the Raiders, I started actually with Joe Gomes. So Joe was working with the Army side, with their special missions unit and their special operations guys. And he took a job with the Raiders and then asked if I would come work with him over there. So I had worked with them up to that point. I've also done a little bit of work, some consulting work with some other teams, a few players with other teams, Golden State, Utah, Oklahoma City, the Thunder, St. Louis Cardinals now I work with as well.
That's fantastic. So you've mentioned Exos a couple of times, and you've been on the Performance Nutrition Advisory Board for Exos, formerly known as Athletes Performance, for several years now. I understand that one of the things you do when working with former NFL players is to walk them through ways to improve their diet and to start eating right. So what does quote-unquote eating right look like?
You know, it's different for each person, I think. But for one thing, we know that an inflammatory state exists for people who have a poor diet. And what does that mean? Well, you're eating processed foods, let's say, you know, processed meats, deli meats and hot dogs, or, you know, those kind of things. You're eating really high carbs, refined foods that create an inflammatory response or drive the immune system to create an inflammatory response. So if you're looking as an athlete, let's say NFL with concussions. So you're an athlete who's looking to protect your brain. It's not just about calories in, calories out. They're taking in massive amounts of calories. Let's say if you're an offensive lineman that weighs 330 pounds, right? Most of these guys have some lipid disorders. They may have some glucose sensitivity issues. They're just big people and they have those things. Mm-hmm. So we know that those people have a hard time with production of pro-resolution mediators. They also tend to have more oxidative stress. So if you look at second impact syndrome, that's a hypometabolic state of the brain with high reactive oxygen species. They're damaged brains that are inflammation, and then they have a second impact. It's catastrophic. What's the difference between taking somebody who's had a, you know, physical injury that has a metabolic problem in the brain versus somebody who has a metabolic problem in the brain because their diet is poor with inflammatory fats and high sugars and things that create a metabolic state that's not healthy for them. It's, mm-hmm. I don't think there's much difference.
And when you're working with athletes, your focus is to keep them healthy and play at peak level throughout their entire season. So what are the key components of that besides diet?
A big issue is sleep. Sleep is huge. If you don't sleep at nighttime, you don't repair. And it's pretty, you know, that's pretty black and white. Most of your repair hormones are released at nighttime. So we look at athletes and not at all encouraging the use of anything that's a performance enhancing drug, but if you're just looking at the numbers and you want growth hormone to be good so that you can repair, if you want testosterone to be good to help repair, you know, ligaments, tendons, help with muscle recovery, you can't get there if you don't sleep. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are not good. The peak of growth hormone release is typically about 2 to 3 a.m. You have some spikes, about 7 spikes or so during the day, but your biggest one's 2 to 3 a.m. So when you have guys that are always on the road and their time zones change constantly and they practice every day, you know, for basketball season, it's not 9 months out of the year, but they get 3 days off a week. I mean, they're 9 months out of the year and they might get 3 days off a year. Mm-hmm. Same with hockey. Mm-hmm. These guys, their sleep pattern's disrupted and you have to find ways to help them to relax. One thing that I've learned from some smart people over at a company called Tignum is that if you look at people who travel and go through time zones, one of the things that happens to them when they travel is they lose the production of saliva. So salivary production is lost. So eating a heavy, heavy meal on a plane creates some other issues. Hmm. There's a connection between gut and brain, as an example, which we know now the lymphatic system connects. Mm-hmm. We know the nervous system, half of your nervous system lines the GI tract. So there has to be a link there as well. So anything that you can do to keep somebody in a state where they're not stuck in fight or flight, they're not stuck in sympathetic overdrive where they can't calm, they can't relax, they can't, you know, fall asleep, they don't stay asleep, their catabolic hormones like cortisol are high, that's a state where they can't repair. So monitoring those, working on sleep, giving them some tools that they can use to help calm themselves. And, you know, whether that's biofeedback, neurofeedback, that's doing relaxation techniques, that's, you know, meditation or even yoga or something that gets them out of that state of fight or flight is helpful. And mm-hmm. and there are things that they can take that are nutraceuticals that are helpful for that. Things like L-theanine or, mm-hmm. you know, some herbal agents like ashwagandha that works on the GABA receptors in the brain tends mm-hmm. to be calming and they're safe.
Mm-hmm. And do you ever look at heart rate variability as a way of measuring the extent to which people are in a balanced state with respect to fight or flight? Do you look at that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Heart rate variability is a great tool to look at that. You know, we don't know all the answers to, you know, how to correct everything or, you know, what level specifically for each person that they hit a point where they crash. But you can see trends. And so if you're monitoring heart rate variability in somebody and they have a drastic change, you can almost see the performance drop within
Absolutely.
About a week or so. I mean, it's a drastic change.
The Ohio State wrestling team had looked at that very, very closely, and they see a direct correlation in the performance of the athletes with HRV scores. And in my own life, as well as the wrestlers at Ohio State, the thing that seems most effective at improving it is float.
Yeah.
Float tank experience. Sometimes it doubles. In my case, I'll go in and I'll come out. It'll be roughly double the next morning. What it would have been.
Yeah, that's a great tool. If you've never done sensory deprivation tanks, if you've never done a float tank, I would encourage you just to try it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great tool.
I wholeheartedly agree on that one.
Yeah. I think another tool that I think is, it's emerging anyway right now, and I think has a lot of promise is in the world of neurofeedback and neuro EEG evaluations and being able to basically see the patterns of interaction between different communication levels or patterns of interaction between different areas of the brain. And I think you can mitigate some of that stuff through neurofeedback as well.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
So as we briefly discussed earlier, concussion and mild traumatic brain injury has become a widely appreciated problem for the NFL. Can you describe the immediate as well as some of the delayed symptoms that players experience? And then what are the types of treatment that they typically go through?
You know, they usually will get an on-field evaluation and they're looking for tests that basically give a very objective score back to say this person has had a concussion. So we have to follow some different protocol as to, you know, return to play. The vestibular oculomotor exam or VOMS, I may be saying that wrong, but VOMS basically is a great test where you're moving your head, staring at your thumb, moving side to side, up and down, and that usually reproduces the symptoms. That's a non-invasive, very simple test that can be done on the field and is very, very useful. Looking at auditory evoked potentials has a lot of promise. I think visual field testing has a lot of potential. I mean, those are great ways to see what's happening within the brain because there's so many pathways that are involved. You can see different areas of the brain that are injured by just seeing what the eyes do. And to me, that's kind of the future of where things will go. Right now, it's more questionnaires that people you know, answer and respond to, but those can be, you know, messed with. So I don't think that that's the future at all. I think that's just temporarily what we're using. We do obviously look at anatomical studies like MRIs and CTs, but what we really need is physiologic studies. And that's where the visual scanning, the things like right eye or different tools like that are so helpful. Mm-hmm. Knowing what's happening within the visual system, or doing a Loretta scan, or doing a functional MRI that's a very high magnetic field with tracing that's involved. Those are the things that I think are the future of how we have to look at these things, SPECT scans even. So a physiologic test to see a metabolic problem is what's needed. We can't see metabolic dysfunction by taking a picture, by taking a CT scan, MRI, until the metabolic dysfunction has been present for so long that the brain is basically destroyed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you'll see on autopsy or, you know, somebody who's basically late stages of Alzheimer's disease, yeah, you see the changes that are there. But in order to catch things early, we have to have something that's more physiologic.
On the sidelines, are they still asking questions like, who's the president? Or I remember in college being asked, what courses are you taking? You know, and I wondered how the coach would know what the answer was. In other words, I think any courses I said would have constituted a right answer.
Yeah, it's definitely more detailed than that.
But that's good.
it's very much more detailed. But and I think that they're being more cautious with guys. They're not just allowing them to, you know, give the thumbs up and run back on the field.
Good.
You know, people recognize in general that it's that second impact is going to be disastrous for them. So giving them time to recover and recuperate. And I think one thing that's changed recently too is we used to tell people that rest is best. You know, stop moving, stop doing anything, sit on a couch. That's not actually best. Mm-hmm. So doing some activity, there was a study up at Toronto, David Lawrence, a great guy, sports med physician up there, works with the Blue Jays, did a study on activity with concussion, and the outcomes are better if you can move early. That doesn't mean you should do high intensity training, but you're doing some kind of training, some aerobic training that, you know, pushes you a little bit. Mm. And I think that follows the pattern of healing for just about anything. You know, we used to tell people, don't move after a back injury, you know, lay up in bed and don't do anything. But that old study by Deo up at, from Washington found that that was disastrous for outcomes as well. So it makes much more sense to me. You know, we're looking at biomarker testing, and there are tests. I think that we'll have tests that come back quicker and give us more detailed information, but understanding the process of what's happening with a concussion or with a metabolic dysfunction. I mean, if you look at the tryptophan pathway as an example, tryptophan as an amino acid, it doesn't have the same transport system as the rest of the amino acids to get into the brain or to get into anywhere. So we've kind of known this, you know, this theory of fatigue with exercise, that you burn through glucose and you start using some amino acids and tryptophan kind of concentration-wise goes up and then it starts to make you feel tired. Mm-hmm. But if you understand what's happening with tryptophan will convert to 5-hydroxytryptophan and then that converts into serotonin and then serotonin will become melatonin. One of the things we know that happens to people who are concussed or people with brain injury is they lose sleep quickly. So we were talking about sleep and recovery. Melatonin production drops. Why does that drop? And part of the reason is because you have an alternate pathway for tryptophan. Tryptophan gets converted into something called kynurenic acid, and that happens with inflammation. So you activate something called indolamine, and this happens both in the gut and in the brain. That's another link. Indolamine converts tryptophan into kynurenic acid. Kynurenic acid then interferes with NMDA receptors. Hmm. So it's almost like a protective mechanism that's there. The problem is that if it accumulates a little bit downstream from kynurenic acid into something called quinolinic acid is the opposite. It stimulates NMDA receptors, causes neuronal death. And that's the link that there is, that at least that's a lab link that we found that is associated with suicide. So people are using things like ketamine to try to block that response, and it does work. But if you understand the pathways, the metabolic pathways, you might be able to catch that early enough so that you don't have to put somebody on ketamine. Maybe you see the inflammatory reaction happening sooner and you start to respond to that with diet, with nutraceuticals, with change in lifestyle pattern. trying to get people to sleep, as an example. Magnesium is one of the cofactors that converts quinolinic acid into NAD, which is important for signaling and also for Krebs cycle function. So magnesium is one of those things that's depleted after a traumatic brain injury rapidly, and it also helps to control, when magnesium is present in the right amounts, it helps to control cytokine signaling from the immune system. So it downregulates that inflammation response.
I often wonder how much of the benefit associated with the float tank is from magnesium, transdermal magnesium.
Yeah, I don't know, although I mean, it certainly would make sense to me. Magnesium absorption happens through the skin.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. You know, we discredit that as a source of, you know, possible replacement, but absolutely does absorb. And you're in this environmentally deprived state where your brain can actually begin to shut off. So you're not constantly processing information and you're getting magnesium. I think that does play a role.
Yeah,
I mean, I've never seen studies on measuring magnesium levels afterwards, but that's what I would imagine.
You would imagine they'd be substantially elevated. You're in there for 90 minutes, bathed in magnesium.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
So similar to football in the military, both groups that you've worked with extensively, as we talked about earlier, hockey is a sport where concussions are a concern given the high speed pace and impacts that are associated with the game. Are there efforts for tracking TBI in professional hockey?
There are. I think they're in the early stages of doing that. There's a lot of argument. If you watch what happens with the NFL Players Association and the NFL, there's a lot of argument. You know, NFL argues that CTE doesn't exist. I think the NHL has kind of taken the same stance, from my understanding. But in general, I think medical staff, they understand that there's a risk. They understand that a traumatic hit to the brain activates, you know, an inflammatory response. And so what we try to do is to take an active role in trying to downregulate some of that stuff if we can. If you can support mitochondrial function so that you don't have that hypometabolic state, I think very promising. Obviously, we talked about pro-resolution mediators for the inflammatory state, but ketones, exogenous ketones, I think are very exciting as a possibility to help with that. There's been some studies on N-acetylcysteine, some small studies done on N-acetylcysteine, which tends to down-regulate glutamate excitotoxicity. It serves as an antioxidant itself and raises glutathione levels. The argument against it has been that it may not cross a blood-brain barrier, but after a traumatic injury, everything crosses.
Yeah.
So even if you can increase your glutathione production in the liver, and that is useful then for the brain, it would make sense. And there are some studies that are done on that. If you look at literature on post-traumatic headaches, there's good supporting literature for giving things that support mitochondrial function, B vitamins, alpha lipoic acid, carnitine. You know, these are things that have been studied with success. You know, if somebody takes them for a period of time, post-traumatic headaches tend to improve. And if you think about it, again, go back to your biochemistry and think about it from that standpoint, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And so kind of summing up the way you approach TBI and concussion, which I really appreciate, because instead of putting a Band-Aid on the issue, you're looking at getting back to the core of the injury and trying to fix it from the inside out, essentially. And you and I have discussed at length the need for individuals who are diagnosed with TBI to see someone who practices something along the lines of integrative medicine. So you're not just having them see the neurologist, but you're having them see somebody who can look at the whole system in place and then give them a solution. So can you expand on what you think an optimal care plan would look like for someone after they're diagnosed with TBI?
Yeah. You have your, I think we're very good at the initial workup right now. You know, do you have a concussion or not? I mean, I know we're still developing tests to be better about that. But what happens in the secondary phase of injury, so, you know, primary again is coup contra coup axonal shearing. That secondary phase is inflammation, immune activation, oxidative stress, the problems with mitochondrial function and NMDA receptor activation. What do we have as tools to be able to solve that? What drugs fix it? None. There aren't any.
No.
You know, people have suggested things like statins. They're destructive for mitochondria. So, you know, they're not saying that there's not a role for statins and other issues, but just in general, we don't have those solutions in traditional medicine. You know, traditional medicine plays its role, but there's also a role for things outside of that. So looking at metabolism is important. Looking at cellular metabolism is important. Understanding somebody's genetics, you know, are you ApoE4? Are you high risk for having problems with metabolic dysfunction after a traumatic hit? I think that's important information to give to the person so they can make an informed decision about whether to play or not.
Mm.
Another aspect is what happens with prolonged inflammation. And this kind of goes back to what we were talking about with hormones. We were talking about this with the operator community and the retirees. You know, they have these low normal levels of hormones, and you can't put a sticker on it and say, you have symptom X, Y, and Z, so therefore you have disease X, and here's your prescription. It doesn't work that way in these type of metabolic problems. So when inflammation goes on for a long period of time, they start to develop neuroendocrine dysfunction. It's about 40% of the time that they'll develop a neuroendocrine problem, and that takes up to 2 years. Mm-hmm. So that's another relatively new thing that we're finding. So is that tertiary injury? Is that a third phase of injury, or is that still part of the secondary injury? I think because of the timing of it, to me personally, my bias is that it's a third phase. We haven't been labeling it as a third phase, but I think it's a third phase. And if you've got, you know, 20% of guys in that community coming back with a concussion, and, you know, not just one, but they're exposed to multiple concussive blasts with, you know, breaching or you know, parachute jumping and just day-to-day things that they have to do, you got a 20% chance coming back with a concussion. And then of that group, then it's a 40% chance of having a neuroendocrine problem as a result of it. And we're not doing a good job of addressing that. So I think when you look at levels like testosterone, you have to do it carefully. You cannot look at testosterone in a bubble or through a straw and say testosterone by itself exists and doesn't have any relationship to things like cortisol and estrogen. I mean, there's a whole metabolic tree that exists with cholesterol. Cholesterol becomes pregnenolone. Pregnenolone has function in the brain. If testosterone levels are really high, you inhibit luteinizing hormone production in the brain, and luteinizing hormone is important in the conversion of cholesterol to pregnenolone. So you can squash neurosteroid production quickly by doing too much in the way of testosterone or an anabolic agent. So it has to be done carefully, and has to be done with the idea that hormones are like a spider web. They're all connected, and you have to have a balance of these things. But I think that is part of the future of what has to be done. We have to look at hormones, have to stop talking about it like it's a performance-enhancing drug. Mm-hmm. When you've got somebody who has an injury, we're willing to put people on, you know, sleep medications to help them sleep, and then put them on Adderall or a stimulant to try to get them up during the day. But all we're doing is trying to correct that, you know, sympathetic, parasympathetic response that gets broken, and some of the fatigue that happens in some cases from neuroendocrine dysfunction. We're not addressing the problem. We're treating the symptoms.
Yeah.
In the special ops community, there's a lot of talk about establishing individual baselines for neuroendocrine function. You know, it's not one size fits all. And so a lot of these people previous to service had abnormally high levels of some of these hormones, unusually high, and then they come back and now they're low normal, which 10 years ago would have been abnormal, but we've adjusted the scale for our declining population. And then we say, you're normal. But there has never been anything normal about these guys.
No.
Right? And they're not normal.
Right.
And so it always concerns me when I meet with them and they tell me, oh, well, I can't get any help. My doc says I'm normal. My testosterone's 300. And I was like, dude, you could not have been 300.
I totally agree. And in defense of the people who created those normal values, it's an attempt. I mean, they're trying to figure out, I mean, you can't just say anybody who walks into a doctor's office and says, I want testosterone. Oh, okay, well, you must be low because you want it. So they're trying to establish some sort of normative data, but there really isn't much, you know, that says that if you're at 300 or if they pick 250 or whatever the number is, if you hit 301, then you're normal. Mm-hmm. I mean, if your symptoms are that you're having difficulty with recovery, you have anxiety, you're not sleeping, you're losing muscle mass, insulin regulation issues are starting to develop, you know, you're having sexual dysfunction issues. A lot of these guys will go home and, you know, they go to their families and there's no sex drive. Well, that's not normal for these guys. So now there's family dynamics involved. And you know, let's say they went from, like you're saying, let's say they were 1,200 and now they're at 301.
That's common.
Technically, they're in range, but they have all the symptoms of hypogonadism. What do you do?
Yeah.
And it's probably not reasonable to just say, sorry, tough luck, you know, here, go take your Prozac and we'll see you tomorrow.
I mean,
that's not a reasonable approach. To me, that doesn't seem like a reasonable approach, but I think we have to look at it like you're saying. I think they're doing some of that, gathering the data beforehand, before these guys start to have the concussive exposure, the high stress, the lack of sleep. And there's other issues, you know, the environmental factors that they're exposed to. heavy lead exposure because they're shooting, you know, you're practicing with 10,000 rounds a day. I mean, you're going to get some lead exposure. And they're in the propellants and in the primers, the different aspects of the bullet, there's other metals, you know, and then you have an injury and have an MRI, contrast MRI with gadolinium, which is neurotoxic. There are a bunch of things that they're exposed to that they're neurotoxic because they disrupt mitochondria. Then you add stress. And then you add trauma, it's a setup for a problem. And we're seeing that with the, I think with the PTSD and the suicide risk, I think your smoking gun is from a biological standpoint is there, but it's kind of putting that information together and figuring out then what can we do, what's reasonable to do. And it's not always that somebody who's 35 years old, they may not need testosterone replacement. We need to figure out how do you, what are the natural options to help? You know, what are the lifestyle factors that you can use to offset that? How can we support a normal inflammatory response and a healing response? How do we support sleep? But then there are certain people where that pituitary dysfunction is just not restored. What can you do? And testosterone is not the only solution. It's, you know, there's other things that work. HCG is a, you know, example that has FDA approval for
DHEA and other things.
DHEA, Clomid is a fertility drug. So these things are useful and they work. And the answer is not always testosterone replacement, but we have to do something.
Yeah, people too often confuse normality with optimality.
Yeah, true.
And those are two really different things, particularly in today's society where Homer Simpson is essentially normal.
That's right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just adjust our normal for what society's normal is. And if, you know, the obesity rates are skyrocketing, then we just say obesity is normal. So, you know, I'm relatively thin guy. I mean, I'm 5'11", 175 pounds. But at some point in time, do I be, you know, am I put into a category of cachexia because, you know, now the societal norm would say that I'm too skinny. But I mean, health-wise, that's obviously not true. It's a kind of a ridiculous statement, but I'm just making that point that, you know, we can't use that for adjusting what norms are.
Absolutely. Well, going back to what we were talking about before with SPMs and DHA and EPA, do you think increasing DHA and EPA consumption would be beneficial for TBI patients?
I do. And there are studies, it's what we see is the studies that have been done, there's a lot of them, but some of them show a dramatic improvement and you have some that say no change. Mm-hmm. So what's the missing link? I mean, why is it so confusing? Is it error on the side of the people doing the study? Well, it could be, but I think our missing link is the pro-resolution process. Certain people may genetically not be able to make them. And, you know, if you're in a chronically inflamed state, you may not be able to make them well either. It's a very slow process. We know as an example, a biological process example that you can look at, if you take flaxseed oil, right? So you take ALA, theoretically, you can convert that to EPA and DHA and have everything you want because that conversion process happens. You know, delta 5, delta 6 desaturase converts those things and you end up with tons of DHA, but we find that that doesn't work. That's why we supplement with fish oil or we tell people to eat fish because DHA is so vitally important. I think that same issue exists within the production of pro-resolution mediators. Mm-hmm. It's a slow process. If you want something to change quickly, I think you have to include pro-resolution mediators. And I'm not saying take SPMs and then stop taking fish oil. I'm more thinking from the standpoint that you probably ought to do both.
Mm. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Earlier, we briefly discussed APOE status. And I once had the opportunity to suggest to a representative of the NFL that they should look at that for every player and make it known to the player what the APOE status was. This was not warmly received, though it seemed like a good idea to me. I wonder about the NFL Players Association. That would seem like something they could undertake, not in a punitive way, just in an informative way. You know, you say, look, you're an APOE4-4, and you've had 6 concussions, and you're financially set. Maybe you should do something else.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that it's scary, right? Because once the legal system gets involved in something, it changes how we view science, unfortunately. So it should be, to us, we're scientifically oriented. The legal system is not part of it. And I'm not saying that attorneys are bad by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just saying that when those two things are involved and that becomes the primary driver of the decisions, it's a problem. So you have to go back to the scientific basis of it and what's ethical. I mean, you look at a kid who's got all the talent in the world, but he has to understand what his risks are. The parents need to. It's not even something that really should be debated. You give the person the information and let them make an informed decision on their own, whether this is something they want to continue with or not. Maybe that needs to happen at the collegiate level. Maybe that needs to happen before they get to the NFL.
Even high school.
Yeah. I mean, we do it with let's say basketball players. You know, some of these guys that are so tall have problems with their aorta or problems with vascular structures. Mm-hmm. And that information is given to the player beforehand, to the team. You know, if you have a high risk of aortic rupture, if you remember Hank Gathers from the sudden cardiac death and collapse on the court.
And Lenny Bias.
Lenny Bias, absolutely. You know, there are examples of that exist. And I think that the NBA stepped up with the players and said, this is the right thing to do. Let's figure this information out before the person gets there. It's not fair to throw them on the field or on the court if they're going to die. I mean, it's not fair to the fans either, but you know, to the player and to the team both, it's just not fair. And I think the NFL has to get with the Players Association in a more cooperative manner. Those two ends need to meet and say, can we do what's in the best interest of the guy beforehand? And, you know, I think that'll have less of an impact on the game.
Yeah, I strongly concur. Can you talk about the NFL pilot study that's using in vivo multimodal imaging to look at neural inflammation and brain atrophy in former NFL players?
You know, I can't speak to a lot of specifics about the study. I do know that there have been studies done looking at MRIs of retired NFL players. And obviously, you see consistent changes with atrophy. But one common thing that you see kind of going along with some discussion that we've had earlier is hippocampal atrophy. So particularly the right-sided hippocampus seems to be affected consistently in those players with CTE.
Hmm. So we've been talking about brain injury and DHA, EPA, and SPMs, and it's interesting. So recent literature suggested a potential link between uptake of DHA and SPE precursor and Alzheimer's disease or dementia development. And I found this particularly interesting just because of work that I did in Alzheimer's disease and also brain injury and APOE status. So it's kind of leading into this overall question. The study that was done in 2017 by Yassine et al. Showed gray matter uptake of DHA in young adult APOE4 carriers is significantly higher than age-matched non-carriers. And APOE genotype has been shown to be a significant risk factor for development of Alzheimer's disease, as we know. So the thought is that increased uptake may be related to increased regional brain activation and higher cognitive abilities that are observed in young adult APOE4 carriers. And as these adults age, the hypothesis is that this greater uptake of DHA, which yields cognitive benefits at a younger age, also increases susceptibility to greater brain DHA loss due to increased metabolic demands and also brain exhaustion and memory failure with age. So based on these and other recent findings, it's been suggested that APOE4 carriers should increase DHA consumption in order to meet the greater metabolic demand for DHA in the brain. And there have been clinical trials that have reported cognitive benefits from increasing DHA consumption in cognitively healthy APOE4 carriers. So what are your thoughts on the role of DHA and EPA consumption for maintaining optimal brain health and also preventing the risk of dementia? Or do you think that SPMs would be more efficacious?
The action of how EPA and DHA work happens through pro-resolution mediators. Mm-hmm. So they're, just like we were saying with omega-6 fats, it's a key that doesn't have any teeth. And omega-3 fats, there are some functions. For example, people who tend to create too many fatty acids, you know, triglycerides, the enzyme sterol CoA desaturase, I think is the enzyme SCD, is upregulated by insulin, fructose, and sugar, but it's downregulated by exposure to omega-3 fats. And so it has a function of lowering triglycerides in patients that have that problem, hypertriglyceridemia. So there are some roles, and obviously DHA is very important near the synaptic cleft and in vesicles. It's part of the structure of those. Whether or not all of that function, though, it could be substituted by just taking DHA by itself, I think that requires healthy tissue.
Right.
So as you age, you start to lose the ability to produce pro-resolution mediators. If you have metabolic dysfunction, whether that's insulin resistance or, you know, fatty acid resistance, let's say leptin is an issue, leptin resistance. I think that those things also play a role in whether you're capable of converting omega-3 fats into the pro-resolution mediator. So my take on it, at least my understanding, is that you probably need a lot more for brain injury of omega-3s, EPA and DHA, but you ought to be on pro-resolution mediators at the same time. And for a period of time, we started thinking that DHA was all you needed for the brain. You know, you just take DHA and you don't need to take EPA. I think there were some supplement companies that were just selling DHA by itself.
And it's specific to some of these studies that have only focused on DHA consumption. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. The problem is that if you look at what happens with EPA and DHA, the G protein couple receptors, where you have pro-resolution mediators have action, resolvin E, which comes from EPA, is very active with those, with downregulating NMDA receptor activity. So if you have hyperactivity of those NMDA receptors that happens because of the trauma and glutamate influx, and then, you know, calcium comes into the cell and disrupts protein metabolism and disrupts mitochondrial function, in order to downregulate how much of that happens, you need EPA as well. So DHA has an extremely important role. There's resolvin D, and there's a whole bunch of those that are resolvins that also work on NMDA receptors. I think they're more, if I remember correctly, the resolvin D is a postsynaptic effect and resolvin E is a presynaptic effect with some of that communication. But resolvins are important. Protectins have a role, and there's some preliminary studies looking at protectins and what happens with tau protein that seems to decreased production of tau, and then maurescens, which causes the regrowth of tissue. So repair is going to be important, and those come from DHA. Mm-hmm. So I think even though you have a huge role for DHA, and I think there's an increased need, and that study shows there's an increased uptake, it would make sense to me to do a lot of supplementing with it. I think you still have to have the activation. There is some activation of different pro-resolution mediators that happens with taking aspirin, and that's not necessarily dose dependent. If you look at from omega-6 fats, LOX, the enzyme LOX, converts to lipoxin A as one of the mediators. That was the very first pro-resolution mediator discovered. And Harvard discovered that, I think, four decades ago. Mm-hmm. And I might be off a little bit on my time, but I think Bayer Aspen bought the patent for that because they knew it was activated by aspirin, and it kind of sat for a while because they were working on R&D and other things. Well, Harvard bought the patent back and then continued the research and found it's not just the omega-6 fats involved in that pathway. The omega-3 fats also tend to be involved, and lipoxin A tends to be a trigger to switch you from omega-6 pathway to the omega-3 pathway. So mm-hmm. aspirin plays a role in SPM production, but it also plays a role in some of the conversion from D-series resolvins that you get and protectins that are a little bit different than what you make on your own. But we know that aspirin may have a beneficial role in Alzheimer's disease as well. And it's mm-hmm. probably not the antiplatelet effect. I think most of what you get as far as benefit from aspirin will probably at some point find that most of it comes from the stimulation of production of pro-resolution mediators.
It's really, really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not dose dependent, you mentioned.
Not.
So even the small aspirins probably have that effect.
Baby aspirin.
Baby aspirin.
Yeah. It's hard. You just can't use that with athletes, with these, you know, the military guys that are in trauma situations. You know, for a patient who's, you know, 60, 70 years old and having some mild issues with cognitive function, it probably makes sense for them. Mm-hmm. If they're not contraindications, they'd have to talk to their doctor. But
right.
if they're not contraindications to having a baby aspirin, you know, even if it's three times a week or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. Combining that with the SPMs.
So we've been talking about APOE and the concept of personalized medicine. So, you know, being able to target therapeutic approaches based off of your genotype is heard all over the media and in the literature. So what do you think the role of genotyping will be in optimizing our nutrition, fitness, and overall wellness?
Well, your genetics are your loaded gun.
Mm-hmm.
So the gun's loaded, then your environment pulls the trigger. The way that I think about it, and I have a friend that, you know, I kind of have my own model, but he has a probably better way of explaining it than me. And I think he's a third year family practice resident up in Georgia. It's with the Army. He's a great guy. We're on a foundation together. But if you look at what happens, the difference between optimal health and then disease, there's sort of a progression that happens. And optimal health becomes suboptimal health. And your genetics are part of that role, but it's your environment. You know, what do you put in your mouth? Your food activates certain genes, whether those are going to be good or bad. Are you going to turn on an inflammatory response of COX-2, as an example? You know, inflammatory fats and sugar and, you know, advanced glycation end products that happen from chronically elevated sugar, those things activate genes that are pro-inflammatory. But likewise, there are things that you eat in your diet that do the opposite. They mm-hmm. they activate genes that maybe stimulate FOXO, as an example, the longevity gene. So food plays a vital role in that process. Exercise plays a role. What things, toxins do you get exposed to in your environment that activate genes that are not good for you? So electromagnetic radiation, as an example, we're around it every day now. What kind of an effect does it have? I don't really, I can't say that I'm an expert in that, but I think that that probably does play a role. And likewise, being in a comfortable, non-stressed environment probably plays a role. So being in that optimal health, you have to watch environment. If you know what your genetics are, you can probably pair more what works for you from a diet standpoint to be in that optimal range. You know, some people do better with diets that are maybe higher in fat and less in carbs, and maybe the other way around for some people. You know, I've done my own genetic testing, and I'm one of those people that doesn't do well with saturated fats. I don't metabolize them well. And for me, I've always kind of felt that way. I mean, I've never, people look at me like I have three eyes and a horn on my head when I tell them I've never liked bacon, ever. Yep.
Sacrilege.
Yeah, exactly. It has always made me feel sick to my stomach.
And that was coming from the vegetarian, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that you'll find some people do better with vegetarian diets. And if you understand what you can and cannot get with different types of diets, then you use nutraceuticals to fill those holes. That's really what their role should be. Mm. A vegan, as an example, is going to have a harder time getting B12. Yeah. They're not going to get carnitine. It's hard for them to metabolize fats because they don't have that carnitine shuttle into the mitochondria. So
Choline.
Yeah.
I mean, go down the list. Yeah.
There's a lot of things. Yeah. You know, somebody who's who just sticks a slab of meat on their plate every day, they're going to have a lot of deficits, right? So, I mean, you know, fiber and antioxidants and those kind of things. There are different diets that probably fit for different genetic types. I think we're at the very early stages of figuring that stuff out. But it's really exciting to know that at some point, we can probably take an athlete or take an operator or even just take, you know, Joe Blow off the street and say, your genetics say you're very likely to develop this disease unless you have this as part of your diet regularly. You know, breast cancer with cruciferous vegetables as an example. So if you take cruciferous vegetables that produce something called, or they have something called indole-3 carbonyl, which is a chemical that combines in stomach acid to form diindole methane, that helps with metabolism of estrogen. Certain people don't metabolize estrogen well. So estrogen accumulation, particularly in people that maybe have a high stress environment, so progesterone will convert into cortisol in stress state. So their progesterone levels drop. Their estrogen production may be normal, but they can't get rid of estrogen. So they're in this estrogen dominant state. And so there's always growth of breast tissue. They're constantly stimulating growth of breast tissue. Their genetics say that they're at risk of estrogen dominant genes. That person is much more likely to get breast cancer than somebody who has a diet that they mm-hmm. mitigate that risk with.
Yeah.
Methylation, you know, that's another one. You know, MTHFR deficiencies, looking at methylation and the pathways it's involved with. Insurance companies stopped paying for homocysteines, well, at least Blue Cross Blue Shield did, which I think is a huge mistake. And I encourage patients to go get that test done outside of their insurance if their insurance won't cover it. Because if you know, if your homocysteine level is really high, what does homocysteine do? Well, it upregulates interleukin-6 as a cytokine. That's a problem for bone density because it activates osteoclast activity. It interferes with cross-linking of collagen. So it's a problem with bone density again. It's a problem for, you know, ligaments and tendons. It's a problem with collagen within the vascular lining. So if you're damaging the vascular lining with high homocysteine and somebody happens to have another gene that elevates lipoprotein A, which is a protein on the outside of LDL cholesterol. So that attaches then to this defect and their risk of heart disease goes up whether they have high cholesterol or not. Mm-hmm. Homocysteine also activates NMDA receptors. Well, we're talking about people with brain injury. Is that a problem? Absolutely. So they already have hyperactive NMDA receptors, and because of the high homocysteine and you add an injury on it, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And you can see studies linking homocysteine with things like Alzheimer's or poor outcome from stroke recovery as an example. You have to go back and understand metabolism. It didn't just fall out of the sky. Homocysteine has an association out of the blue. Mm-hmm. There's a link. So if you know that and you can do methylated folic acid or depending on the pathways that are involved, it could be B6, it could be trimethylglycine that's involved in that pathway to help lower homocysteine. It could be that they need, you know, acidental methionine or they need a lower regular methionine level. So there's a bunch of things that are involved in that pathway and you can't just study folic acid by itself and say, well, it is or it isn't a risk factor for heart disease. There's a whole bunch of pathways that are involved in the production of eventually getting to glutathione, which is an antioxidant that protects your cells. So that homocysteine's in the middle, and your genetic makeup, MTHFR makeup, determines how well you're going to do that process, and that determines your risk for disease. Yeah. That's one example.
With respect to sleep, what are the common deficiencies and recommendations for people who have trouble falling asleep, and also for those who have trouble staying asleep once having fallen asleep?
Falling asleep is, you have to look at sleep hygiene issues. You know, looking at blue light before bed, that tends to stimulate your production. If you think about the way we are supposed to be in our environment, you know, the sun comes up and it's nice blue skies and that wakes you up, perks you up, makes you feel energetic, right? The sun starts going down, you get orange light. Well, in your brain, you start to produce, in the pineal gland, you start to produce melatonin. So it gets you ready for bed and being tired. So understanding some of the processes involved, you can change your lifestyle a little bit. Stop staring at blue screens. Don't read, you know, newspapers or political things right before bed that are going to get you aggravated and irritated. And, you know, news makes a lot of money on irritating and aggravating people, and people buy into it, but it keeps them awake. Yeah. So sleep hygiene's one aspect. Another aspect is what happens with, you know, the metabolism. What's going on chemically in the brain? And on the sympathetic side of the nervous system, you know, your deep brain, your sympathetic parasympathetic balance that we kind of touched on a little bit, that plays a big role in whether people can sleep or not. On the sympathetic side, to just make it simple, you know, this is your gas pedal. That's your fight or flight side. Dopamine, which comes from tyrosine and D-phenylalanine as amino acids, that dopamine converts to adrenaline or norepinephrine, then epinephrine, raises your heart rate, increases cardiac output, but makes you more alert. But the main chemical in your brain that is excitatory or is a gas pedal is glutamate. So glutamate levels go up, stimulates you. And if you're cortisol level is high because of stress, it raises those excitatory neurotransmitters. It comes down to survival. And you don't want to be in that state when you go to bed. So on the opposite side, you have parasympathetic. That's rest and repair and recovery. And that's the break. That's the calm side. So the two big things that you would think of would be serotonin. And we talked about tryptophan pathway a little bit. Serotonin becomes melatonin. But serotonin is calming, and GABA. GABA is your main break. And glutamate converts to GABA. It requires B6. So a B6 deficiency, a poor diet, low in vegetables, you have a B6 deficiency, you're going to struggle, right? If you're in an inflammatory state and you've got shunting away from melatonin, you're not going to be able to sleep. So diet plays a role. But there are other things that you can look at in those pathways. GABA can be stimulated, or you can use things that are in nature that are not addictive that help with that GABA-glutamate balance. Things like L-theanine, which is in green tea. You don't want the caffeine with it, but if you have L-theanine, L-theanine tends to downregulate glutamate production and GABA goes up. So does dopamine. Serotonin may be affected by that. 200 milligrams of L-theanine has been studied to cause alpha wave activity in the brain, which is a calm, relaxed state that you want to be in before you start to fall asleep. So that's been studied and shown to be effective. You can combine that with something, an herbal agent like ashwagandha, which binds to the GABA receptor. That can be calming. And understand that most of these things that are natural, you can still overdo. You can still have a problem or have it interact with something, but it's much more forgiving than taking Valium or Xanax or yeah. Ambien or something that's a prescription that works on that GABA receptor.
Yeah. So Dave, you give out a lot of advice to athletes and guys in special operations, as we've been talking about, on ways to stay healthy and maintain their peak performance. So in terms of your own performance, how do you go about taking care of yourself? Because I know you have a really busy schedule. What does your diet and fitness routine look like?
Well, I try to do something every day. There's probably 2 days a week where I don't do anything really, you know, significant. But I'll try to get on an elliptical, even if it's 15 minutes. You know, take the dog for a walk, or, you know, I try to get out, do something active for a little bit just to unplug. The reading, prayer, meditation, that stuff is important for your brain to be able to unplug. And I try to take some time, you know, even if that's 15 minutes to just unplug during the day. I try to do something that I enjoy every day. Fortunately for me, a lot of my job, I just love. Mm-hmm. So it's like I get to go to work and do my hobby, which is a lot of fun. But I exercise regularly. I mean, I wouldn't say I run every day, but I probably run, I'd say, 2 days a week. I'll bike 2 or 3 days a week. I try to lift and do 2 pretty heavy lifting sessions a week and then 2 lighter sessions a week. So I'm trying to do a combination of things. And that's a period of time for me where I'm not in that fight or flight mode. If I'm pushing myself hard and I do high intensity, I am in that fight or flight mode. So I have to find something else to kind of offset that. But I might do that once a week or twice a week. But for the most part, when I lift, I'm trying to unplug. I'm not thinking about work. I'm trying to not be in that zone of, you know, work and stress and stress, things that I'm worried about. So that's a big part. And then from a diet standpoint, I feel best when I have my diet consists of trying to get in about 5 servings, 7 servings of vegetables a day. I'll eat some berries. I don't eat a ton. And it kind of depends on how active I am. I tend to cut back on carbs when I have a day that's at the office and not as much activity, but I stay with good carbs. I try to avoid sugar. Doesn't mean I'll never have it. I mean, I'll go out with my wife and have, you know, dinner and have a dessert just so we can hang out. But for the most part, I'm trying to avoid having sugar, refined foods. I'll eat lean meats. That's not for everybody, but, you know, I'll eat chicken or turkey or fish, and occasionally I'll have red meat. And I eat eggs, and, you know, I may have 3 or 4 eggs in the morning, but I don't eat the egg yolks every single time. I don't eat all of them. So that I've found works for me. Mm. And I keep my weight relatively stable. My body composition is kind of where I like it to be. I might fluctuate a little bit, but I've always been relatively thin. And I have days where I do intermittent fasting. Mm. So I'll take a period from 8 o'clock at night until, you know, noon the next day. Water, I might have black coffee. I might even take exogenous ketones, just kind of feel like my brain perks up a little bit when I do that. And I might do that about once a week.
Okay. Mm, it's funny, I eat only the yolks.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say you guys could split it out.
Between us, we should have breakfast, right? Yep. I have a friend in California, in fact, that he's an MD, PhD, he's on our board, and the waitress pointed that out at breakfast. You know, we're in California having breakfast, and she looks at our plates and says, you know, you guys need to work something out.
Yep.
Right there, you have a whole egg.
Yeah, exactly.
So I understand on that note that your wife, Angie, is a fitness competitor. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. She does figure. She's a professional. She does pro figure. Yeah. More as a hobby than really, you know, it's not something she does for a living. It's more something she does because she enjoys it.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, it's been fantastic having you on the podcast today. We've learned a ton and it's been a great discussion.
Yeah, it was great fun.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for the time. We enjoyed it also.
STEM Talk.
So I have to say, Dave is so versatile when it comes to practicing medicine, and he really keeps up with the latest research. The story that he told about getting into metabolic medicine training because he felt he was missing something in his toolbox really captures the spirit of the way that Dave practices medicine. He treats the whole person, and I'm pretty sure that's one of the reasons the Stanley Cup champion Washington Capitals and others rely on him.
I particularly appreciate the way he works to figure out the appropriate therapeutic treatments for each individual person. There is no one-size-fits-all way to treat something as complicated as health and in particular inflammation. That's why I think Dave's use of specialized pro-resolving mediators is so interesting. If you can promote the natural resolution of the inflammation process, it just makes a lot of sense to me to try and help people with their injuries without the use of most of the conventional anti-inflammatory drugs. Dave is really helping pioneer this new approach to treatment.
If you enjoyed this interview as much as we did, we invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us. This is Don Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.